Welcome to Business Watch. The rand continued its slide against the dollar yesterday, touching the weakest level last seen in August 2020. We have strengthened a little bit though, but we are on track for another week of pain in global markets as global recession fears have intensified. Asian stocks hit a two-year low this morning and are heading for another weekly loss, while the dollar is set for its third week of gains as a fresh slew of rate hikes around the world has deepened concern about the outlook for global economic growth. Data released this morning showed China's economy contracted sharply in the second quarter, while annual growth also slowed significantly, just highlighting the colossal toll on activity from widespread COVID lockdowns, which jolted industrial production and consumer spending. Overnight, Wall Street fell after weaker than expected earnings from JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley. That's certainly fanning fears of a sharp economic downturn. This week, we also saw the Bank of Canada surprising markets with a 100 basis points hike. We saw central banks in South Korea and New Zealand announcing 50 basis point hikes, and in Singapore and the Philippines, authorities tightened policy out of cycle to tamp down on inflation. Lots to discuss with Warwick Lucas, head of Galileo Securities, and Raymond Parsons, professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University. Warwick, it's all about the king dollar at the moment, which will obviously hurt U.S. earnings. Do you see the Fed intervening at all at this stage?
Michael, in terms of the dollar itself, I would have said generally not. I mean, bear in mind that the U.S., while a massive economy, is actually quite insular. So I think the dollar is to them a lot less of a problem than it is to everyone else, frankly. As that old saying goes, it's our currency and your problem. So I would have said no influence from the Fed at this stage in relation to currency levels.
But obviously a strong dollar does hurt U.S. corporates, and no doubt they'll be agitating, certainly at a lobbying level. Raymond, what do you make of this strong dollar story and the potential here of the Fed intervening?
Well, I think that the interest of the Fed in particular there will be on inflation, and they will be meeting in about 2 weeks' time, and I think it's now generally accepted that, in fact, they will probably increase interest rates there by 75, if not 100 basis points. So I think from the point of view of inflation rather than the dollar, they will be certainly reacting there. I would just like to stand back, if I may, and if we look at the global picture, I think we're beginning to see various convergent trends emerging, whether it's about the weakening in the global economy, the outlook for inflation, the issue of the role of monetary policy, the fact that several central banks have now joined the party and are putting up interest rates by a significant amount. I just thought that, of course, at this point, it is important for central banks to carefully calibrate what their reaction should be. It's not easy. These are tough calls to make. But I thought it would be interesting to look again at someone who spoke a lot about monetary policy, who supported monetary policy as an important stabilizer, and that is Milton Friedman. And he was also saying, of course, central banks are the mechanism, but I have some very serious caveats that I would like to place, he said. Firstly, that central banks, if they make a mistake, it's a huge one, and the chances are that if they make a mistake, it will be destabilizing. He also said there must also not be too much dependence on central bank personalities. So it's important to have a monetary policy committee, for example. He also thought that central banks must avoid undue influence from other bankers in the system. And finally, he warned, and most specifically, be careful you're not tripped up by the time lags. So I think that's tremendously important for all central banks now as they converge on what they need to do. And I think you also see that the general comment is that they must be driven by data, not by dogma. And secondly, they must be nimble. Mm. I think that's the important point.
I think the time lag question, Warwick, is very important, isn't it? Because we're seeing inflation roll over in some categories. So yes, while the US CPI print backward looking was high, some of the forward looking numbers are saying, well, potentially we've peaked.
Absolutely, it's important, Michael, and it's particularly important because this is not really demand-side inflation that we're dealing with. It's supply-side inflation, which has been an animal that we haven't seen for really quite a number of years in the global context. I mean, if we just look at, for example, general global volatility of the likes of GDP growth and inflation, in the last 30 to 35 odd years, it's been much more stable in both the case, in the case of GDP and inflation than before. We had a period in which businesses were encouraged by governments to invest. They had stable economic policy that made a relative degree of sense. And this led to decent amounts of supply, and really central banks just had to nudge a bit this way or nudge a bit that way as circumstances occurred. But we haven't had this kind of supply side problem in a very long time. And the problem is with supply side inflation is that monetary policy has very little impact on the whole. Mm. And ultimately, you're going to have the fix come from fiscal policy. You have to have the encouragement for investment in capacity and a restoration of those supply chains, and that takes capex, and capex takes borrowings and investment, and all of those two pointers run up against a high or aggressive monetary policy environment. So what that's going to mean is that central banks are actually, once they've quite gotten over this initial surge, are going to actually have to tolerate a higher structural level of inflation for quite some time until we have a restoration of the supply side mismatch. Mm. So that means the central banks are going to have to rein in their traditional aggression in terms of monetary policy. And of course, they have their own problem in that all of this liquidity created in order to buffer against the COVID shock has, of course, limited the wiggle room that central banks now have. So we've got quite a delicate tightrope walk coming up here.
And I think, Michael, if I could just add to that to say that, just to remind us of what we said before, that although there are these convergent factors which are determining the global outlook, and this has been confirmed by the IMF recently. They say that is true. But just remember, when in circumstances, particularly now, where you have to translate this into your domestic economic circumstances, yes, central banks have to act, but the degree of reaction must now be driven to a much larger extent by your domestic economic circumstances. What are the trade-offs there? What is the data in your country telling you? And therefore, what is then the most appropriate response from your central bank and your monetary policy?
And we can already see, and we're going to touch on it later on in the program, the wage demands starting to be made and coming through thick and fast in this season of bargaining as well, which are really concerning. I want to come back to a BlackRock note this week that spoke of a regime shift, Warwick, and clearly that's important when it comes to your investment themes that guide you in this new era. What is BlackRock thinking about what this regime shift means for investors and what sort of themes they should be focusing on?
So they've consolidated some of the points made a little earlier very nicely. They've just highlighted that with where we are, it's just quite simply once central banks have run out of room in terms of interest rate policy, they're going to find that the damage that potentially happens to growth and jobs from overdoing the fight in inflation would actually prove to be a bit too much, especially those central banks that run on dual mandates. So they also point out that, of course, with the whole environment that we're looking at here, I mean, there's quite simply going to be a risk that investors demand higher risk premium, whether it's in stocks or bonds. And of course, that's going to mean, if you follow through, that that your asset allocation is going to start have to be being much more mobile, for lack of a better word.
Yep.
It's there's going to be quite a lot of ebb and flow that we haven't had before. The past investing environment from say the early 80s to the global financial crisis, we're actually relatively simple one-way bet, and that's certainly not the case now.
Yeah, and they also see an era of structurally higher commodity prices ahead, which goes into that theme of tolerating higher inflation, which I think is a number of important considerations for how one would position your portfolio in South Africa, and also from a macroeconomic perspective for the country. I think fiscally, Raymond, if we are in for a period of structurally higher commodity prices, that is something of a good news tailwind to counter some of the negative headwinds that we encounter, largely own goals around policy and a lack of execution. But at least that should support the currency to some extent. I want to move on, though, to the other important talking point this week. And one gets the sense that the country is on a knife edge again. You know, the sense is that we are one step away from another bout of unrest. And if you look at it, the Small Business Institute believes that the state's weak capacity to maintain law and order is getting exposed almost every week now. We've got rising fuel costs. There's the wage increases that we're talking about, the cost of living, poor service delivery. Just how important is this in terms of your analysis? Are we close to another tipping point in South Africa?
Well, I think, Michael, we've got to take these warnings from the business community seriously, both from Business Unity South Africa and the Small Business Institute, because they don't normally step forward so strongly on this kind of issue. But they've now conveyed a very important message to the country and to our decision makers that the issues of law and order, of civil unrest, of crime, are now at the top of the list. They rank equally with whether we can keep the lights on or not. I think it's equally important for the perceptions of investors and the investor confidence that we are busy rebuilding or seeking to rebuild, that we want to be able to say, look, we are getting on top of the law and order issue, but in particular, we are going to take whatever preventive measures are needed on the law order front to ensure that there will not be a repetition of what happened last year. Because we want the economy to realize its 2% plus growth, which we said last week was very likely, despite some of the headwinds we're facing. But I come back to my point. All countries are facing headwinds. The extent to which it harms you is how you set your sails. And one of them we've got to do is to convey the message that we will not allow what happened last year to happen again. And whatever law and order steps are needed to support that perception will be implemented. And I think what the business message is, they don't see much sign that that is being implemented, and that ranks as important for the perceptions of growth and employment in South Africa as keeping the lights on.
It doesn't help when your police minister is busy arguing with members of the public, NGOs and others who raise these issues and defaults to mudslinging and petty politics. And we've seen a rise of tavern shootings in the townships, as well as a general decline in law and order. It does seem like there's a rudderless police service that needs serious reforming. Warwick, in your analysis of this, you know, how serious is the decay in the rule of law and order in South Africa? What's the perspective here on some of these broader socioeconomic issues, and whether or not they're being given sufficient attention by a government that, quite frankly, is stretched at the moment? It's got the energy crisis to deal with, there for many in the ruling party, internal factional battles, and now this. One feels that we are literally, you know, one more crisis away from another insurrection.
Well, I think part of the problem, Michael, is that a lot of issues that should be straightforward civil society issues are politicized, and of course that immediately aggravates efforts to solve them. And I think South Africa is particularly prone to that kind of politicization, first of all with general heightened sensitivities on a multitude of issues. And even if an issue starts out as not political, it doesn't take too long before someone stirs the pot and puts it front and center into the political pot. And it's part of our maturing of our democracy. We've got to realize that things like law and order are not political. They should not be political. They are simple civil society issues. Mm. They need to be dealt with sometimes, frankly, mechanistically, regardless of your political affiliations. And they need to be implemented as part of not only creating more investment certainty, but also creating a society that is more stable and certain, that will invest not only in businesses, but will also invest in homes, yeah. invest in their schools and in their local society. Because without law and order, that doesn't happen.
As we turn our attention now to the stalled public sector wage negotiations. Now, in a step which takes it closer to a strike by more than 200,000 public servants, and which certainly tests the government's pledge to maintain fiscal sustainability, we saw the Public Servants Association lodging a dispute with the government after wage negotiations stalled this week. The process now goes to the Public Sector Coordinating Bargaining Council for mediation in the weeks ahead. In the one corner is the PSA, who wants an inflation-beating 10% rise across the board. In the other corner, we've got government presently offering 2%. Now, their negotiating stances are currently worlds apart, as we see, and at the same time, several SARS offices have been closed as the pay strike there continues. SARS says the demands of employees are simply unaffordable at 12%, unless SARS receives further funding. Overall, Raymond, what is at stake here economically and politically? Because this is really going to test the political capital of the new finance minister.
Yes, Michael, look, this is a serious matter, because I think it is a serious test and can be a source of serious future tension in our society. If you look at the wide discrepancies that you have here, for example, the current negotiations from the Public Servants Association, they want 10%. And what is government offering? 2%. In the case of SARS, which is another source of industrial action, that they want 12%, and the government's offering about 2%. So there are significant tensions here that will have to be resolved. It not only affects the public sector, but it also becomes a role model for the private sector. We've seen that in the auto industry, there's now a claim for about 20%. Yep. So I think this is a very serious issue that needs to be managed. Also, I'm sure that the Reserve Bank is looking at this and saying, we worry about inflation expectations, about wage price inflation. Where is this going to take us? So quite clearly, these are serious issues that require very skillful strategies to negotiate over the next few weeks. But more importantly, what is worrying is that the word productivity doesn't seem to feature very strongly. In other words, would we worry if someone wanted a 10% increase if the increase in the productivity was 15 or 20% in that sector? No. So we mustn't be nominal about it. The fact is that this is purely based on entitlements without any link to where can you bridge the difference of opinion or these negotiating stances by finding common ground about productivity gains. I think that is tremendously important. It needs to feature a lot more strongly. It's not easy. It's not easy, especially in a service sector, to measure productivity. But I'm not sure we see a commitment there to say we can't go on with wage and salary claims at this level without running into huge trouble with our economy and it being totally counterproductive. So what are the strategies, what are the creative strategies, especially built around productivity, which can help us to bridge the outcomes that we would be able to live with, which are affordable and which look more like a win-win outcome rather than a win-lose outcome?
And Warwick, I'm usually quite critical of the unions, but where I am fairly sympathetic. And I had the GM of the Public Servants Association, Ruben Maleka, on the show this week. Is when you have this conversation, and I raised productivity with him, it's a very granular type conversation, because he was of the opinion that nurses, teachers, and even workers at Home Affairs are extremely productive. They're just under huge pressure because there are staff shortages in the key frontline positions. And here there are too many paper pushers at senior and middle management level. And so when you have a conversation with the public sector about productivity, you have to talk about allocation of resources. Where are human resources being allocated? And where are we seeing workers taking strain? And one can also be sympathetic with the price of, you know, goods rising, fuel, food, all of that. So it speaks to management, doesn't it? We need better management of the public service.
Well, very much so, Michael. And I think that's a big part of the problem here, is that I think in the numbers, we are probably seeing by proxy other problems coming through. The fact is that notwithstanding that state wages are generally quite generous, they are not particularly good employers. And by that I mean they neither encourage excellence nor do they root out incompetence. So anyone who has a lot to offer and figures out ways to do things better, they don't have any way to advance and push forward. And where you have colleagues that are holding things back, and often it's just a minority, it's almost impossible to get shot of them or to constrain them or rein them in. And I think that goes to a big part of public servant dissatisfaction, of those who will can't and those who can't stick around. So government needs to figure out how to be better managers, but they also need to be sure in the process that they get the unions on board, because, of course, the first bit about rooting out any incompetence, and you have the unions waving the flags like mad, and we go back full circle to our very enlightened labor legislation, instead of being used as a shield, becomes used as a sword.
Yeah, very
important. I think, Michael, what's important here also is, if you look at the research today, it's not so much an issue of the size of the public sector, because if you take global standards, our public sector is not that excessively large. But what the research is saying is that the remuneration is totally out of line globally. And what you need to do to get that right, without penalizing the deserved cases or where there's an equity consideration, you've got to strike a new balance by saying part of whatever outcome is now found in these negotiations will be an overarching productivity accord. Needs to be part of this outcome. Then you can re-engineer it in a way that enables you to find common ground. At the moment, it's purely adversarial.
Yeah.
There is no common ground. And the common ground has to be found by unpacking the basic productivity imperative. That's what we need to address. And I'm hoping that perhaps this conflict might force us in that direction.
One hopes we have a skilled mediator there, Warwick.
I think just perhaps a thin end of this wedge is, let's look at the current issues happening at Kuberg. They are suffering a disastrous loss of skills and general morale in a plant that is highly specific, very high level of skills, very niche skills. And, you know, who says that Eskom or government are the best managers there at all? So surely something like that especially should be considered for outsourcing the management of the entire plant to someone like Framatome or Westinghouse and so on. I mean, those are specialists in nuclear power. They know all about it, and they don't have the problem procuring international skills that Eskom clearly does. And, of course, Kuberg is absolutely essential to the power balance in the Western Cape because of the whole power shape of the power grid of the country.
Well, that's a very important point. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. If it was up to me, I'd outsource the entire government and get rid of the lot, because they're probably paying consultants to do their job anyway. That was Warwick Lucas, head of Galileo Securities, and Raymond Parsons, professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, putting your week into perspective here on Business Watch. We'll be right back.